at 8 o'clock. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has mounted a robust defence of the Liberal Democrats' performance in the coalition government. In a speech that he's just delivered at the opening of the party's conference in Birmingham, Mr. Clegg said Liberal Democrat ministers were punching above their weight in the coalition and were fighting tooth and nail for the things they believed in.
This government has Liberal Democrat written through it like a stick of Brighton rock. We didn't win the election, so we can't do everything we want. But we're doing a remarkable amount. Make no mistake, we are punching above our weight.
The Equalities Minister, Lynn Featherston, speaking at the conference earlier, said she was delighted to announce the government's plans to legalise same-sex marriages. Heavy fighting has resumed in Libya for Sirte, the birthplace of Colonel Gaddafi. Troops are coming under heavy fire from Gaddafi loyalists. Earlier, the fighters had to regroup when Gaddafi supporters repelled them from Bani Walid. South Wales police say the bodies of the four men who lost their lives in a mining accident have now been formally identified. Gary Jenkins, David Powell, Philip Hill and Charles Breslin all died when water flooded into the Glacian Corollary. The Northern Ireland Deputy First Minister, Martin McGuinness, has said he hopes his decision to stand for the Irish presidency will not be divisive and upset the victims of violence. He's expected to be formally selected as the Sinn Féin candidate tomorrow. The film director, Roman Polanski, is to collect a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Zurich Film Festival later this month, 2 years after he was arrested in the city on child sex charges. He'll receive the award he was due to collect before the arrest. Last year, a Swiss court ruled against extraditing Polanski to the United States to answer charges dating back to 1977. BBC News.
Now, I'm sure you'll have realised already that this week Radio 4 is doing something rather special. We're devoting an entire week of drama slots, apart from The Archers, that is, to just one production, based on a book that the KGB tried to prevent from being published, Life and Fate by the Russian author Vasily Grossman. His epic tale of an extended life, family life, during the Battle of Stalingrad is being told so that you can listen to the dramas as individual stories or in full as an intricate tapestry of interweaving tales. The drama itself begins tomorrow at 3 o'clock. But now, as a curtain raiser, we journey across the former Soviet Union in the company of Jim Reardon to tell the story of the creation of the novel. It was a work that terrified the Soviet regime, and it turned its author from war hero to heretic. Here then is The Life and Fate of Vasily Grossman.
Dear Nikita Sergeyevich, I ask you to release my book from jail. There is no sense, no truth in the present situation whereby I am physically free, but my book, to which I've given life, remains in jail. 12 years have passed since I began writing it. I still think, as I did then, that I spoke the truth. I ask you to release my book.
So wrote Vasily Grossman to Khrushchev. The reply? His book Life and Fate wouldn't be published for 200 years. Yet he was a man read and loved by millions of Soviet people. And for us, there is no better travelling companion through the Stalin years, from revolutionary to dissident, a voice of the people seeking truth. His epic novel is the Soviet War and Peace, giving a voice to ordinary Soviet citizens, as well as to national leaders. It's painted on a vast canvas of war, and it constantly poses questions of freedom and truth.
Every epoch has its own capital city, a city that embodies its will and soul. For several months of the Second World War, this city was Stalingrad. The thoughts and passions of humanity were centered on Stalingrad. The capital of the war against the fascists was now no more than the icy ruins of what once had been a provincial industrial city and port. Here, 10 years later, was constructed a vast dam, the product of the forced labor of thousands of prisoners.
The book's conclusion, that Soviet communism and German fascism are one of a kind. Perhaps it's no surprise that the state seized his book. What brought Grossman to such a radical view? Daughter Yekaterina.
He began as a liberal young man devoted to revolution ideas. but he was always very honest with himself, and he wanted to know what way is the most true. And he came to idea of kindness, senseless kindness.
During the period of all-out collectivization, he'd seen special trains packed with the families of kulaks. He had seen exhausted men and women collapse in the snow, never to rise again. He remembered one ragged peasant woman, mad with hunger. She'd just eaten her two children. I saw the sufferings of the peasantry with my own eyes, and yet collectivization was carried out in the name of good. I don't believe in your good. I believe in human kindness.
Grossman was witness to what the poet Ossip Mandelstam called the wolfhound century, which devoured millions in wars, famine and purges. Grossman's uncle, his second wife and her first husband, all fell victim to Stalin's terror. Eventually, the wolfhound jaws were to snap shut on him too. Carol Garrard, Grossman's biographer.
He was born into a secular and non-practicing family, and he was born in the town of Berdichev, and in his correspondence, he calls this horrible Jewish town. He found himself to be a Jew in the eyes of so many of his neighbors, and yet he himself had never wanted that identity. He wished to be a Russian, and he was only disappointed that he couldn't be regarded that way.
Berdichev was a Jewish center in the Russian Empire's Pale of Settlement, yet Grossman spoke no Yiddish and was no fiddler-on-the-roof Jew. His parents were educated abroad. They weren't religious, and he left home to become an engineer and build socialism. But his passion for writing led him in another direction. And ironically, his hometown was the setting for the story that put him on the literary map. This was followed by a long novel, Stepan Korchugin.
There is Russia, Sergei thought and stopped, suddenly lost in a rush of unfamiliar ideas. There in front of him was Russia, his mother country, his native land. In this land he had been born. Here he had spent his life. Here he would die. But how was he to live?
Now Korchugin was about to win the Stalin Prize when the Kremlin crag dweller decided otherwise. Too truthful, too Jewish. A first reminder of Grossman's place in Stalin's society. Just months later, the invader was at the gates.
Here's a bulletin just received over the KIRO News Bureau. Adolf Hitler, after assailing Soviet Russia bitterly in a proclamation read to the world by radio, ordered the Nazi armies to march into the Soviet.
Граждане, братья и сестры, бойцы нашей армии.
All writers to the front, pen in one hand, rifle in the other.
As I watched the retreat, it was as though I were witnessing the original Exodus in the Bible. Huge hordes of sheep and cows, the screeching of wheels on carts, thousands of refugees from Ukraine, white and black faces of children, biblical beards of Jewish elders, headscarves of peasant women, tall hats of Ukrainian priests, black-haired girls and women. The clouds and sky remind me of the engravings by Doré showing the biblical scenes of divine powers threatening the earth.
As soon as war broke out, Grossman immediately volunteered, like almost all writers at the time.
Stalingrad historian Anthony Beevor.
But he was so unfit and overweight, and he even had to walk with a walking stick, the girls next door used to refer to him as Uncle because he looked much older than his early 30s. But the one thing he really wanted was to be able to join the staff of Krasnaya Zvezda, the Red Army newspaper. And eventually, Ortenberg, the editor of Krasnaya Zvezda, he agrees to take him on, but he said, I can't send you to the front at the moment because you have no military experience. He wasn't a member of the Communist Party, and so he couldn't be an officer. And they didn't want him to be a private, otherwise he'd be having to salute everybody. So basically, Junior Quartermaster Grossman was given a uniform and a pistol. And funnily enough, Grossman actually turned out to be rather a good pistol shot.
I'm sitting in the Russian State Archives for Literature and Art. Snow is pelting down outside. And the main archivist, Yelena Gasparova, has just come in with a great pile of Grossman's war diaries. You can feel the pain and the shock of Grossman as his car is approaching Stalingrad.
Stalingrad сгорел. Писать пришлось бы слишком много. Stalingrad сгорел. Сгорел Stalingrad.
Stalingrad was on fire. There was too much to write about. Stalingrad was on fire. Stalingrad was on fire.
General Krylov lay down to sleep in the bunker. His temples throbbed and his throat burned. He had smoked dozens of cigarettes that day. He licked his dry palate and turned over to face the wall. Then he heard a roar and a splash. He opened his eyes and found everything in flames. There was a stream of fire running towards the Volga past the open door of the bunker. He could hear shouting and rattle of Tommy guns. Put this over your head, quick, shouted a soldier he'd never seen before. He was thrusting an overcoat towards him. Suddenly he realized what had happened. The oil tanks were on fire. Flaming oil was streaming past towards the Volga. It seemed impossible to escape from the liquid fire. It leaped up, humming and crackling from the streams of oil that were filling the hollows and craters and rushing down the communication trenches.
Каждый знал, что убежавших стрелять на месте страшнее немцев.
Everyone knew that anyone who ran away would be shot on the spot. That was more terrible than the Germans, to direct fire against your own people.
The war correspondent in the Soviet Union was expected to write according, obviously, to the party line and to bolster hope. This, in fact, of course, proved counterproductive, and basically the propaganda often fell flat. But Grossman didn't really want to have anything to do with that. He wanted, as Ortenberg later acknowledged, to convey the ruthless truth of war.
In the middle of the battle for Stalingrad, Grossman wrote two of his most famous accounts. The first one was written round about the 6th or 7th of November, the anniversary of the Russian Revolution. It's called Through Chekhov's Eyes.
The sun rose, bathed everything in light. Such was its vital force that even the miserable city seemed to smile, a faint, wan smile. Only under the protruding wall where Chekhov lay, there was a cold, grey shadow. A German, carrying an enamel plate, turned the corner. Raising the crossed hairline of his sights, he shifted them 4 centimetres forward from the soldier's nose and fired. A black spot suddenly appeared beneath the soldier's cap. His head jerked backwards, and the pail fell with a clatter as he crashed sideways.
Because of the proximity of the enemy, it was inevitable that the sniper really came into his own. Grossman makes a hero of these people and actually never feared for his own life. Lived a charmed life in the battle, for goodness sake, wriggling on his stomach to lie alongside this fearless boy.
Chekhov could not help trembling with excitement. The young man who wouldn't hurt a fly as a boy had been turned into a killer by the stern and sacred logic of patriotic war. He had become a merciless avenger.
Grossman didn't expect to survive Stalingrad.
he had his technique whereby he would actually sort of sit down with the soldiers and he'd just start chatting. He wouldn't conduct a formal interview in any way. He would never get out a notepad. What is, I think, so striking is there is Vasily Grossman, an obvious Jewish intellectual from Moscow, who does not look at all military, manages to win the trust of the soldiers and the officers very quickly indeed, because they knew he was straight.
Sunset on the square. Terrible, strange beauty. The gentle pink sky is reflected in tens of thousands of empty windows. A huge poster in striking colours. A bright future. The city is dead. It is like a person who dies after a long illness and is rewarded by eternal sleep. Yet more bombardment. Bombing of a dead city.
Just crossing the river Volga from the east bank to the west bank was in itself a matter of taking your life in your hands, because the river was under full enemy bombardment. The Germans were bombarding it. In many cases, they were even able to cover it with direct machine gun fire. So it wasn't just a question of dive bombers and fighters strafing any boat that tried to come across. It was a constant thunder of artillery and so forth. Once they were on the east bank, then, it was war in three dimensions. It wasn't just a question of facing death horizontally on the ground. You could be attacked from above by fighters. Shells could explode in the top of buildings and you could be crushed by falling masonry. The water was utterly polluted. It was the stench of burning and rotting bodies from under the ruins, because by that stage, tens of thousands of bodies were decomposing in the ruins all around them.
I have dreams of Mamayev Kurgan. Dreams. Koshmar nyet prosto snitsa. I just have dreams of Mamayev.
Yeremenko heard a faint cry from the area of the factories, a cry that was almost drowned by the shell bursts and gunfire. There was something terrible, but also something sad and melancholy in this long cry uttered by the Russian infantry as they staged an attack. As it crossed the cold water, it lost its fervor. Instead of valor or gallantry, you could hear the sadness of a soul parting with everything that it loved, calling on its nearest and dearest to wake up, to lift their heads from their pillows, and hear for the last time the voice of a father, a husband, a son, or a brother.
Grossman was loved as no other war correspondent, his reports being copied out and passed from hand to hand among the soldiers. And he later wrote that he found freedom from Stalinist tyranny among his comrades fighting for their lives in Mother Russia.
He wrote to me, I was in Central Asia then.
Yekaterina Vasilyevna, Grossman's daughter.
In Stalingrad, which is so much bombed and cannons, noise and tension, it is impossible to read. It is possible to read only War and Peace by Tolstoy.
It's a cold morning in March in Volgograd, and we're at the foot of the great monument, Mamayev Kurgan, this stone statue of a woman, her hair streaming in the breeze, her left hand flung out and her right hand holding a sword above her head to knock back the enemy.
In the line of the main drive, the battalions were moving forward through a storm of flak, through the ruins of houses, through the granite factory building, over the railway lines and through the garden of the city mayor. They moved forward through thousands of bomb craters and above them, the whole hell of the German Air Force.
We're just coming up to the mausoleum. We're passing a very long wall on the left-hand side, and somewhere I seem to have read these words before. They're Grossman's, of course. His famous phrase from one of his short stories called In the Line of the Main Drive. And there's no mention of Grossman's name. It goes something like this. Железный ветер бил им в лицо.
An iron wind lashed their faces, but still the people came on, and once again a sense of terror seized the foe. The people were going on to the attack. Were they really mortal?
We're now inside the mausoleum, with two soldiers standing rigidly to attention on guard. And all around the top, above the bronze wall, with its unfurled banners, in very big letters, is yet again an extract from Grossman. Yes, we were indeed mortal, and few of us survived, but we all carried out our patriotic duty before Holy Mother Russia. Да, слава вокруг. Who, I'm asking a soldier on duty here, who wrote the words around?
Да, это ж работники делали. В 1968 году его открыли памятник.
No, they're just words of ordinary workers who wrote them when the building was opened. Who wrote the words outside the iron wind? Was it a Russian writer?
Ну, это создатели Волгограда.
No, it's the people who recreated Volgograd after the war. Вы никогда не слышали о Василии Гроссмане?
О ком?
Who?
О ком?
Гроссман, Василий Семенович.
That night, the people on the left bank had seen the multicolored flares light up the sky over Stalingrad. The German army had surrendered. The great victory at Stalingrad determined the outcome of the war, but the silent quarrel between the victorious people and the victorious state was not yet over. On the outcome of this quarrel depended the destiny, the freedom of man.
After the surrender came, February 1st, 1943, there began the march to recover what was over 1,000 kilometers of occupied territory, and he was with the 1st Ukrainian Front.
Grossman's biographer, Carol Garrard.
And in a wonderful piece that was printed in Red Star called Ukraina, Ukraine, Vasily Grossman says to his fellow Soviet citizens, I began to feel that we were recapturing not only space, but time, as if every time, every day, we could recapture not just the 3 kilometers or the 5 kilometers of our advance, but we could turn the clock back. And then fate dealt him a terrible blow.
We've come all the way from Volgograd via Kiev. We're now on the road to Berdichev, Grossman's hometown. This is the route that he would have taken.
There are no Jews in Ukraine. All is silence. Everything is still. A whole people have been brutally murdered.
In one of the letters to his father, dated the 28th of July, 1943, he says, I've been traveling along roads like a gypsy for weeks. It's a lot easier to travel during the summer than in winter. The rich fields of flowers bloom as they have before, but sometimes you don't smell the flowers. There's a different and terrible smell.
January 1944. I'm leaving today to go to Berdichev. I've heard that all the Jews of the town have been killed, and that the town itself is almost totally destroyed and is virtually empty.
After questioning people, he would have been given the directions to where the mass graves of the Jews of Berdichev are, and we know that he walked those mass graves physically, literally, just as for the rest of his life, I think he continued to walk them metaphorically.
Our car bumped through the ramshackle town, past the one-time Jewish ghetto, out onto the dusty road leading to the burial pits. 2 kilometers along the way, we stopped by a grassy field, an unnatural greeny-black scrubland of jagged mounds. Like Grossman, I knew what lay beneath.
Units from an SS regiment arrived in Berdichev on 14th of September at 4 in the morning. The signal was given. The whole city was woken by the terrible screams of women and children's crying. The slaughter of the innocent and the helpless went on all day. Their blood poured onto the yellow clay ground. The executioner's boots were soaked with blood.
A mere 24 SS officers to slaughter the Jewish population, aided by Ukrainian police. We met Nina, an elderly gold-toothed Ukrainian peasant, who told us of the shooting. Our guide Sergei interpreted.
The village Nina was living in was just several kilometers from the place we are standing now, near the memorial to the Jews. The nearest village was a Jewish village at the time of the war. She was just 4 at that time. She doesn't remember this, but by the end of the war, she remembers how the earth moved, and it seemed that this field was drenched in blood. When the erosion brought up the bones, the local villagers picked up the bones and reburied them. One of the German soldiers was shot right in Nina's vegetable garden, so they buried him along with the others here.
Somewhere here lies the body of Grossman's mother, Yekaterina Savelyevna. We know that she was 70 years old. She walked with a stick because of diabetes. But as for the rest of the victims in these burial pits, we only know about 500 of the names. Even the figure itself of 18,000 bodies, they could only estimate by the top layer of bodies in one of the pits. Here's a letter that Vasily Semyonovich Grossman wrote to his mother in 1950, 9 years after the massacre.
Many times I tried to imagine your murder, how you walked to your death. I tried to imagine the man who killed you. He was the last person to see you alive. I know that you were thinking of me. Today, I think of you just as alive as the day when we saw each other for the last time, and just as alive as when I used to listen to you reading aloud to me when I was a little boy, and my pain is just as great as it was the day when that neighbor told me you were dead and there was no hope of finding you alive. And it seems to me that my love for you and this terrible agony are just the same now and will stay with me to the end of my days.
From the burial pits of Berdichev to the death camps of Poland and Germany, Grossman discovered the full horror of the Holocaust. Already in 1944, he compiled with Ilya Ehrenberg the Black Book, Eyewitness Accounts of Nazi Atrocities Against the Jews. But Stalin banned the book. We should not divide the dead, he said.
Literary Gazette, 22nd of June, 1946. The people are immortal, their deeds are immortal, but the loss of a human being is still irreplaceable. More than 70 Moscow and Leningrad writers died at the front. Each of them understood life in his own way, saw it in his own way, and also, in his own way, loved goodness. The great patriotic war was all about human rights. Fascism didn't succeed in striking out the concept of human being, didn't manage to drown it in rivers of blood. Human beings triumphed over beasts. Our victory affirmed the right of human beings to live, think, and be free.
Denial of the truth, plus his own guilt about his mother, and awareness of Stalin's mounting anti-Semitism, led Grossman radically to reassess his position as a writer, and also as a Jew.
That communique asserting that Jewish medical men had been guilty of monstrous crimes shocked everyone. But it was said that they had confessed, and if they were innocent but had confessed anyway, that implied another crime. A crime against them more monstrous than the one of which they were accused. Even to think about this was frightening.
Stalin, less than 10 years after the war, was preparing a massive pogrom. Fearing the worst, Grossman hid in the Pierdzielkina dacha of his close friend and Stalingrad comrade, the poet Semyon Lipkin.
We had a cleaner who told us that the boss is ill. And we went to the railway station and we read in the paper that the boss was ill. And so we danced all night because we knew that Stalin was on his way out.
On March the 5th, 1953, Stalin died. Without previous planning, without instructions, Stalin died without the personal instructions of Comrade Stalin.
Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956 at the 20th Party Congress, denouncing the cult of personality, ushered in the period of the thaw. For Grossman, this now meant the mass publication of For a Just Cause, his new novel about the Great Patriotic War, even the award of the Red Banner of Labour for services to literature. Perhaps he could yet become the new Red Tolstoy. Perhaps his new work, Life and Fate, which shared many of the same characters and incidents of For a Just Cause, could honestly now depict the Soviet world. Perhaps. He wrote to Semyon Lipkin.
Am I right? That is the first and main thing. Am I right in the eyes of the people? That is, before God. The fate of the book no longer depends on me. It will realize itself separately, without me, perhaps after I'm gone.
Что у него было хорошее отношение к советской власти долгое и отрицательное отношение к Сталину.
I have to say that in terms of Grossman, he always had a good attitude towards the Soviet system. He hated Stalin, but as far as Soviet power was concerned, he was a dedicated man.
Listen, my friend, this is my last duty as a revolutionary, and I must fulfill it. We made a mistake, and this is what this mistake has led to. We didn't understand freedom. We crushed it. Without freedom, there can be no proletarian revolution. Communists have created idols, put on uniforms and epaulettes, began preaching nationalism and attacking the working class.
Stop! Screamed Gorbachev.
Life and Fate. Did he feel in danger when he was writing it?
It was like flying.
So he was exhilarated. He was very happy when he was writing it.
He often read chapters, interesting chapters to his close people, to family. And when he was angry with somebody, he did not read.
Daughter Yekaterina.
He was atheist, but in many of his books and stories, and very much in Life and Fate, there are not Christianity, it's more humanism.
How close did he feel to his Jewishness? Did he feel himself a Soviet person?
He was сам по себе, как говорят по-русски.
He was his own man.
Very brave to see what is truth. He wrote, I read. It was evident.
The powerlessness of kindness, of senseless kindness, is the secret of its immortality. It can never be conquered. The more stupid, the more senseless, the more helpless it may seem, the faster it is. Evil is impotent before it.
Grossman submitted the manuscript of Life and Fate to the prestigious literary magazine Znamya in October 1960. 2 years earlier, the scandal over the foreign publication of Boris Pasternak's Dr. Zhivago and its subsequent Nobel Prize had deeply embarrassed the Soviet authorities. There would be no second Zhivago scandal. Grossman waited and waited.
I find it very, very hard to see Grossman as naive. I think I disagree with quite a lot of people as regards this question.
Translator Robert Chandler.
I think he was probably quite prepared to be arrested himself. Maybe he imagined some kind of campaign of intimidation, as there had been a few years before against Pasternak. And the Soviet authorities were much smarter this time around.
It's absolutely chilling to have in your hands the KGB document listing their visit to confiscate Grossman's manuscript and to search the flat the morning of the 14th of February 1961. Incidentally, they call Grossman not by the name which he preferred, Vasily Semyonovich, but by the obviously Jewish Yosef Solomonovich. Then we have a letter which Grossman wrote to the secretary of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev.
1 year has passed. I have thought long and hard about the disaster that has overtaken my life as a writer and about the tragic fate of my book. I believe that this book may to some degree be a response to the inner needs of Soviet people. It contains no lies or slanders, only truth, pain, love for human beings. Dear Nikita Sergeyevich, I ask you to release my book from jail. I still think, as I did then, that I spoke the truth. I ask you to release my book.
He wrote the letter to Khrushchev for several reasons, I guess. First of all, he was trying to save his book.
Historian Yuri Bitunin.
He was trying to say the truth. On the other hand, perhaps he was trying to show that he disagreed with such inhuman methods of communication between those in power and Soviet writers. And of course, he was ready to work with editors to retreat somehow. Khrushchev had no wish to talk to Grossman. But he was invited to Mikhail Andreevich Suslov, one of the leaders of the Soviet state, in charge of the Soviet ideology. Somehow it could be a gesture of some respect.
You wrote a sincere letter to NS Khrushchev. That fact is a positive sign. In your letter, you proposed the publication of your novel, Life and Fate. That is impossible. You consider that we have violated the principle of freedom in your case. Yes, that is so, if you understand freedom in the bourgeois sense. But we have a different understanding of freedom. Our Soviet writers must only produce what is needed and useful for society. Your work is dangerous for the Soviet people. Your novel would bring comfort to the enemy. And yet, I will still call you comrade, Comrade Grossman.
He was a busy person, and he had some secretaries who had to prepare materials for him from Life and Fate. They presented to him the most sharp and the most anti-Soviet episodes of this book.
You examine Soviet life from an absolutely non-Soviet viewpoint. You cast doubt upon everything. Why should we add your book to the atomic bombs that our enemies are preparing to launch against us? Its publication would only help our enemies. Publishing your book would only increase the number of victims. It is our responsibility to strengthen the Soviet state and to defend our people. You know how much harm Pasternak's book did to us. I'm going on vacation, and perhaps we'll read Life and Fate. I'd like to meet with you again in a couple of months, but the topic will not be life and fate. If I do read it, then I shall have nothing further to say to you about it. I wish you all the best.
They tortured him by phone, rings every day. Tell that you are not right. Apologize, I made a crime. Some teachers at the school where I worked told me, your father is a coward. He does not go to the Union of Writers to признать.
To confess.
To confess.
They strangled me in the shadows.
It's not only a shock, but it was a cause of his early death. He was 58 when he died. He suffered greatly. He never кричал никогда.
He never shouted out, never
shouted
complained.
Out, but suffered greatly, and he became very thin, and his face became почернел, nearly black.
The last known photograph of Grossman shows a shrunken man on a bench, hunched over and seemingly consumed by the shadows. He died of stomach cancer on the 14th of September 1964, and it seemed that the dark and the silence had fallen over him. The book was still imprisoned. His even more incendiary Everything Flows, which savaged both Lenin and Russian freedoms, sat in what the Russians call the длинный ящик, the long drawer. Suppression of Grossman's memory and work continued throughout the 1960s. But this was also the time of Samizdat, the distribution of multiple copies of banned work. The KGB thought they had seized all copies of Life and Fate, but they were wrong.
Okay, I did it three times at least, but the first time it was in 1975.
Novelist, satirist and dissident Vladimir Voinovich.
I was friend of Semyon Israelovich Lipkin, and we were also neighbors. We lived in the same house. He asked me some questions, which I found a little bit strange. And then he looked at me. I read in his eyes some question. He invited me to the yard, and he asked me, in a whisper, of course, you know, I have one manuscript which I would like to publish abroad, and ask him, it's Grossman.
Everybody has his own version, and all of them contradict each other. All of them.
Historian Yuri Bitunin still wonders at the book's journey.
To my mind, that there was something else we don't know about. There was something that they are keeping in secret.
But if they knew I had this manuscript, they would come immediately. And I was so much afraid to keep it at home. I made me a microfilm myself, but of course it was not a very good quality. And to ensure this process, I took the copy and I visited Andrei Sakharov and his wife Elena Bonner, and ask them to also make microfilm.
It's also possible, let us say so, that there was someone in power. I mean, not the Politburo, I mean, not the heads of KGB, someone who had some power, who could assist them somehow, either with materials or with closing his eyes, because there are too many gaps and too many questions, too many.
I think now it is not secret anymore. Cultural attaché in Austrian embassy, he brought it abroad. Please do anything you can to publish this. This novel deserves another fate.
My faith has been tempered in hell. My faith has emerged from the flames of the crematoria, from the concrete of the gas chamber. I've seen not that it is man who is impotent in the struggle against evil, but the power of evil that is impotent in the struggle against man.
He perished as a fighter. If he wouldn't fight, he would live longer. He fought against it and died as a fighter.
Wherever we would start our own journey in Grossman's life, in his works, in his literary career, the final destination in any conversation is his sincerity.
Today, Grossman's work is enjoying renewed attention and new audiences, including philosophers and scholars, who now find remarkable clarity in his testament to the Wolfhound century. His final works and short stories are at last being translated. Russian television is now preparing to adapt Life and Fate, remarkable in a country where he is still regarded with deep caution. The chapter where a mother writes her final letter from the